Thank you for downloading the Pawneeville Ranch podcast, brought to you by the staff of the Pawneeville Ranch.
Welcome to the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. I'm Erin Brown, Pawneeville Ranch curator.
And I'm Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter.
Well, Anna, the Christmas season is fast approaching, and while the mansion is beautifully decorated thanks to some local volunteers, this time of year is just always a little bittersweet for us. We talked last time about how the history of the Lilly family just sort of pulls you in, and you really start to care for the people that lived here on the property. I think this is especially true when we talk about Billy Lilly, who was born on December 17th, 1916. His life is sadly overshadowed by the tragic way in which he died, but he was incredibly bright and vibrant for someone so young.
I want to warn everybody to have some tissues handy because this is going to get a little intense. Billy's death is so well known and talked about, and there's a lot of rumors and some misinformation that surround him. We've recently begun to change the way that we educate the public about Billy because we believe that he is so much more than just his death. Part of that has been in response to the amount of questions that we get about Billy on a regular basis. And Erin, I can't tell you the number of parents I've had on tour wanting me to tell their young children how Billy died so that they don't make the same mistake. I think a much better way to think about this is to tell your children about Billy's life so that he can be a role model, because he was just such an amazing person. So today's podcast will be focusing on the life and death of Billy Lilly.
Right, and since we've changed the way we educate about Billy, I think we've also had a lot of people take us aside and tell us that they appreciate that we don't just automatically tell about how he died. So there's two sides of that story. But right off the bat, we are going to address one of the biggest tales surrounding Billy, and that is whether or not he was involved with the orphan train. There is this persistent rumor that Billy was adopted by Pawnee Bill and May during an orphan train stop here in Pawnee. I mean, I've been here almost 14 years, and when I first came here, that was what we were telling the public. That is even written in Pawnee Bill's official biography, and it's just completely fabricated.
Yeah, it was one of the first things I heard when I first started working here,
yeah.
too.
Now, the orphan train, just to give you a little bit of context, was a child welfare program that was started in 1853 as a way to send children from crowded cities such as New York and Boston out across the nation in hopes of being adopted. It was a way of disbanding these street gangs of children that had become a problem in some of America's largest cities on the East Coast. It's estimated that nearly 250,000 children, that's a quarter of a million children, relocated by the time the program ended in 1929.
Now, the orphan train was not a pleasant experience. The conditions on the trains were described as little more than cattle cars, where children ages 6 and up would be watched in groups of 30 to 40 by an adult. At each stop, these children would be lined up for prospective parents to look at, and if they were lucky, they would be adopted. These children would do whatever it took to be adopted. They would sing, they would dance, they would just try to charm these people into taking them home with them, basically begging these parents, give me a chance. Very often, siblings were split up, and they were not reunited for many years, and some children were even used as indentured servants by these families that had taken them in. It's truly a tragic piece of American history that not a lot of people know about.
Right. And we know that Billy was adopted when he was 4 weeks old by Pawnee Bill and May. Any child under the age of 2 did not make the grueling journey on orphan trains simply because they couldn't care for themselves. So as far as Billy being a member of the orphan train, we can say definitively that this did not happen. However, Billy's birth happened in a place that, by modern standards, is kind of nearly as absurd to think about. Today, births, you know, can happen anywhere, like in a home or a hospital, but Billy was born in what was known as a maternity sanitarium.
Now, I know what we're all thinking, but we're not getting ready to have a visit from our old friend tuberculosis. There's actually a difference between the words sanatorium and sanitarium. They were both used to describe places where people with long-term illnesses could go, but a sanitarium usually refers to a place that was kind of like a health spa, so it had your spas and your saunas and places to relax, while a sanatorium was generally the term used for places where people with mental illness or a physical illness would be treated.
Okay, so we're going to kind of set a little scene here. It's 1916, and you're a 15-year-old girl. You've recently found out that you're pregnant and you are unwed. What in the world do you do? There was, at the time, a number of cure-all medications that proclaimed a cure, and I'm going to put these words in air quotes because although they don't come right out and say it, they allude to the termination of a pregnancy. Okay, so these medicines would claim to be able to fix, and I'm putting these in air quotes too, irregularities and obstructions, as well as help these women who were temporarily indisposed. But these so-called medications contain some extremely dangerous ingredients like pennyroyal and tansy and paste of lead. In fact, pennyroyal was extremely toxic and led to many deaths from women who had taken it to induce a miscarriage and ended up bleeding to death as a result.
Now, Erin, we love podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
We love listening to them. We love recommending them to each other, too.
Sure.
And there is a wonderful podcast out there called Sawbones, which explores the weird and wonderful world of medical history. I would highly recommend giving it a listen if you're interested at all in the history of medicine. It's fascinating. But they have a saying over at Sawbones, and they say that when it comes to these cure-all drugs from the turn of the century, if the item claims that it cures everything, it probably cures nothing.
Right, and does some damage as well. And there were other options out there for unwed mothers, too. We're going to put up just a disclaimer right now. We're going to talk just very, very briefly about the sensitive subject of abortion. These, you know, we're not giving our opinions. These are simply historical facts, and we think it's important to know the history behind abortion because it tells us a lot about women's history and medical history, as well as changing cultural and social norms.
Now, abortion has a long history. It goes pretty much back to the beginning of time. When you start looking into the topic, they usually start around ancient Roman Greece, but for our purposes, we focus on the early part of the 20th century. In America at that time, abortion was highly illegal, and not to mention incredibly dangerous. That's not to say that you couldn't find a good doctor for the right amount of money, but for most women, the practice was incredibly traumatizing. Before 1930, abortion practices were probably more dangerous than actually giving birth to the child. Most of these people that were performing abortions were not licensed. They probably weren't doctors. They were just doing this to make some money. It was estimated that of the 150,000 abortions that occurred between 1900 and 1930, about 1 in 6 of those women died as a result.
Let's just let that sink in for a minute. 1 in 6 women who attempted to have an abortion died. That is an extremely frightening statistic, and it speaks to the incredible desperation felt by many women at the time. Now, on the other hand, what happened in other circumstances was that the unwed mother carried the child to term and gave birth. They might keep the child, but for those women who could not support the child, nor did they have any support of their own, they would oftentimes give the child up for adoption. And there were any number of ways to do this, but the one that's more important to our story are maternity sanitariums. And, you know, you've always heard those stories about, you know, in the olden days, women being sent off to tend to their elderly aunt for approximately 9 months, and then they would return home looking maybe a little worse for wear, but as crazy as that might sound, it's actually the kind of secrecy in the way these places operated.
Right, and Billy wasn't born in just any regular maternity sanitarium. He was born at the Willows home at 2929 Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. This place would see between 25,000 and 35,000 births and adoptions during its operation, and it was referred to as the Ritz or the Waldorf Astoria of maternity homes. If you found yourself residing there, your family could be expected to pay upwards of $1,000 towards your room and board. Now, that's not a lot of money by today's standards, but what cost $1,000 in 1916 would cost $20,800 today. It was elite, it was comfortable, and most importantly, this place could keep a secret. Privacy for these young women was so important that when the home finally closed in the 1960s, every record of births and adoptions was taken from the facility and burned by staff members.
Good grief. So much history lost right there, too. But let's think about that money. That is almost $21,000 today. I mean, can you imagine just how badly your family would want to hide a pregnancy to spend that kind of money?
I can't even imagine my parents sending me away if I was expecting. And some of these women were, you know, my age, 27, 28 years old. And it's just really a sign of the time that these women were living in.
Yeah. The Willows home was built in 1905, and it was a pretty unassuming white Victorian home. It was sponsored by the Catholic Church, and it was run by a man named Dr. John W. Kepner, who was the chief obstetrician. Beneath him was a veritable army of nurses, maintenance men, assistants, secretaries, and superintendents that kept the enormous operation running smoothly. The Willows home would take in girls of all ages from around the country. They did have girls as young as 12 and women as old as 27 as patients, but most of the young women there were between the ages of 15 to 19.
Now, when a woman was sent to the Willows home, she would arrive at Union Station in Kansas City, which was just a short walk away from the maternity home. These women would usually arrive in the very early days of their pregnancy, before they were beginning to show in any way, and they would stay there until about 3 months after they had given birth, so that there would be no signs of the pregnancy that they had just gone through. If you could not make the short walk to the Willows home from Union Station, a limousine would be sent to pick you up. Once you were a patient at the home, however, you were not allowed to leave, and you would have very little contact with the outside world. Usually the only time these women would leave the facility was if their families came to Kansas City for a visit. And this was all in an effort to hide the fact that these unwed women were pregnant.
And despite the isolation, the Willows home was very luxurious. The doctors encouraged patients to have daily massages to help with the aches and pains of pregnancies. Regular exercise was a must to keep their bodies in shape, and there were also steam saunas and private rooms. I'm kind of thinking I wish I was at the Willows home during my pregnancies. During its heyday, the Willows housed 100 mothers and 150 babies at a time, and demand to stay there got so high that the nurses worked to create an outdoor nursery where children would sleep in cribs under a huge canvas tent.
Yeah, there's still pictures that survive of that today, and it's really amazing to see.
And since there was a full team of doctors at the home, many women would also give birth there. If there was a medical emergency during delivery, the women were sent to a local hospital, usually St. Anthony's, where they would care for the mothers in a larger facility.
And it's important to remind people listening to this that these children were not orphans. They had parents, and they were placed up for adoption. Now, unlike most facilities, the Willows had a reputation of placing their children in homes before they turned 1 year of age. Their method was extremely simple. During the holidays, they would send out postcards to prospective parents, which would advertise the number of children they had up for adoption. And the Willows also took extraordinary lengths to ensure that the adoptive parents were, quote-unquote, matched to their children. So to explain this, Erin, you know, the holiday season's coming up, and you and your husband have decided three's not enough, we're going to have our fourth. So you hop on the train, you go to Kansas City, you go to the Willows home, you go into their front parlor, and the nurses there have picked out three children for you to view. They would show you the children one at a time, and these children would be matched to your physical characteristics. So the first child might have your blonde hair and your husband's brown eyes, and the next child might have his dark hair and his dark eyes, and the last child might look more like you. And of those three, you were expected to pick which one you wanted. So as the child grew up, it was feasible that it could have been your biological child.
No one ever had to know.
Usually, when the nurses presented you these three choices, it was the first one you picked. The first child that they showed you was the first one that was usually picked. And interestingly enough, little girls with blonde hair and blue eyes were usually the most widely requested adoptees.
On January 11th, 1917, the Pawnee Courier-Dispatch reported that Pawnee Bill and May had left Pawnee for a brief holiday in Kansas City. Now, let's look at that date there, January 11th. It's very feasible to assume that the Lillys received one of these postcards from the Willows' home during the holidays. Baby would make a great Christmas present. The very next week, an article appeared in the January 18th, 1917 edition, which said, "Major and Mrs. Lilly adopt a son." The article stated, "Major and Mrs. Lilly made a trip to Kansas City last week and returned with a bright-eyed baby boy. They went to the Willows' home and adopted a little fellow who's just 4 weeks old. This will be a splendid home for this little one, and we hope that he may ever be strong and well, and a source of great pleasure to his new parents." Surprise! The Lillys had kind of fooled everyone with their brief vacation and adopted a baby son.
Now, it wasn't a surprise to anyone that May had always pined for motherhood. She had a child about 1 year after she and Pontybell were married, and all we really know about this baby was that it was a boy, and he died when he was about 6 weeks old. We believe he's probably buried somewhere in Kansas, either in the town of Caldwell or the town of Wellington. The baby was reportedly very large, and May later stated that she had to undergo a surgery that made it impossible for her to carry any more children. Now, we have always assumed that this surgery was a hysterectomy, and it happened when she was still fairly young.
Yeah, like 19.
Yeah. May had filled her life with excitement of show business and of running the ranch, but she really longed for a baby. So imagine how happy she was to have this beautiful baby boy that was now hers to raise as her son.
Yeah, and his given name was Gordon William Lilly Jr., but he was always called Billy. And Pontybell and May truly, you know, they loved Billy as if he were their own. They loved him so much. All you have to do is tour the mansion and see the toy room to see that Billy was adored. There are so many photographs that survive of Billy, and he probably had every kind of toy and game and book he would have wanted. We are so fortunate to have so many of Billy's drawings and his notes and his homework as well. It was really obvious that the ranch captured his imagination. From everything we have seen, Billy was a normal, funny, smart little boy who loved to play and spend time with his friends. He was well known to his father's show business friends, who referred to him as Pontybell Jr. or the Lieutenant.
I love that. Pontybell was the major and Billy was his lieutenant. One of my favorite Billy items is a poem that he wrote for penmanship class when he was in the first grade. We found it recently tucked away inside of a Bible in the mansion, and I think it shows just how he loved his parents. It says, "I am thankful for each little bird, for every flower that blooms, for summer with its sunshine, for winter with its snow. I am thankful for my mother dear."
Very sweet. It's really incredible, you know, how much love was in that household. Through photos, we can see that he had a very special bond with his mother. They're always kind of looking at each other and holding hands and are just kind of obviously enjoying each other's company. With his father, he always looks so handsome and grown up in a suit and bow tie. We have photographs of Billy playing dress up, pretending to be Sherlock Holmes while on vacation. They took him to Coney Island in Philadelphia and showed him parts of the world that even some adults never have seen in their lifetime. He got to meet governors, well-known artists, and Wild West show stars. He had a pet alligator, bison, horses, dogs, a black bear, chickens, and coyotes. It must have been so exciting to grow up on this ranch with everything that Billy had and experienced.
Now, one of the neater things that we've had happen recently was a visit from one of Billy's childhood friends, Mr. Don Stoles. Mr. Stoles now lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is the creator and owner of the longest-running dinner theater in the United States, the Old Log Theater. His father was a Methodist minister, and Mr. Stoles' father actually oversaw the building of the United Methodist Church, which is still here today in Pawnee. The Stoleses only lived in Pawnee a few years before his father was reassigned, but Don had fond memories of living in Pawnee. You actually recorded an oral history with him when he visited the ranch back in June of 2011.
Yes, I love Mr. Stoles, and it was such a great thrill to talk to him. just a little backstory. His children were kind of taking him through this pilgrimage of his boyhood. His sons had, were driving him to everywhere he had lived, where his father had been a minister. And I was really inspired by this pilgrimage through the memories of his boyhood at the age of 90, and wanted to interview him, as he was the only person that I know of still alive that played with Billy in the mansion. One thing that really stuck with me from that interview was his recollection of Pawnee Bill and May and Billy as a family. We often describe the Lilies in terms of what they did rather than who they were. And to hear them described as this loving family unit was very moving for me. Don remembers family dinners, and this cracked me up because he was really insistent that every time he visited, they served him creamed carrots, and he just hated creamed carrots. But he ate with the family a lot, and Pawnee Bill would pick him up at the parsonage and drive him to the ranch in his big car, and it made an impression on him that stuck with him his whole life. He remembers, you know, and this again means a lot to me, that the Lilies were a happy family. Don Stoltz loved the wild freedom that came with having a friend live at the ranch. They just ran all around. They played in the barn. And Don remembers specifically playing with the electric train. He loved that train so much.
And that's kind of where he segued into a conversation that we both really enjoyed because of its tenderness and really its fondness. Don told you that Pawnee Bill and May never let Billy plug the train in because they were concerned for his safety. And he remembered being fascinated by the idea of electricity and the potential awesomeness of having this train that ran around the tracks on its own. But the little boys were very mindful of the Lilies, and they obeyed their wishes. And we both thought that was just so poignant, that they were so protective of Billy and his little friends. And even today, looking at that train, it's so easy to imagine little boys kind of crowded around the tracks, playing with them and pushing those trains around them. And I think it's very obvious from the condition of those little trains that they were very well loved and played with a lot.
For sure. That's really a bittersweet memory, because we all know what happened to Billy and his accident. Don Stoltz was still living in Pawnee when Billy died, and he also has vivid memories of attending his funeral and sitting in the living room of the mansion lined up with the other little members of their third grade class. But we'll talk more about that tragedy in a minute. One reason that we felt really strongly that we wanted to do this podcast, Anna, is because we feel like Billy in the past has been reduced to simply a death story, this tragic tale. And we feel like that really cheats Billy, and it's a disservice to Pawnee Bill and May and their family. He was a little boy who lived life fully and was loved abundantly. He had friends. He loved to draw pictures of the mansion and the buffalo, and he loved to dress like a cowboy and ride his little pony named Ribbon. He liked to pretend to write checks on his dad's old Two Bills era Wild West Show checks, and every night he slept with a rag doll he had named Brownie. And he was kind of a little corker. He loved his parents, and he was, from everything we've seen, just beautiful inside and out. And we can learn a lot from Billy about life and not just death.
Now, Billy was extremely bright, and he loved to act. There are multiple retellings in the newspaper about Billy being in plays at both school and at church, and he always had the starring role. It seemed that he was gearing up to follow in his father's footsteps. He liked the spotlight, and it seemed that he was very friendly and personable with everyone in town. Billy's life was such that his birthdays were reported in the newspaper all the time. An article in the Courier-Times-Dispatch here in Pawnee reports on the occasion of Billy's 8th birthday. Billy Lilly entertained some of his friends at his home on Blue Hawk Peak last Saturday. The afternoon was made merry with various games, featured a number of cowboy stunts and daring acts of the Wild West. Refreshments were served and favors given, and all had a jolly good time. The guests were Donald Stoltz, Frederick Stoltz, Orville Hornbaker, Jack Cash, A.J. Wilkerson, Gertrude Wilkerson, and Mary Barrera.
Oh, that's so sweet. But I think it's pretty common knowledge for people who are familiar with the Pawnee Bill Ranch what happens to Billy just 3 months after his 8th birthday. The Pawnee newspaper describes the tragedy as follows. The people of Pawnee were shocked and dumbfounded last Tuesday afternoon when the words that announced the shocking and accidental death of little Billy Lilly were heard on the streets. How little we know of the things that are in life's pathway just ahead of us. Only a few hours before the untimely death of our friend Billy, he was in our office on his way home from school, his bright little face reflecting the happiness of both his home and school life.
It's just so sad. And there are a lot of rumors that surround his passing, but I think it's important that we need to set the record straight. About 5 o'clock on the evening of March 31st, Billy was playing with a rope on the windmill tower. He had grown up seeing rope tricks and Wild West show acts, and no doubt had probably played cowboy his entire life, as most little boys usually do. The newspaper reports that he tied one end of the rope around his neck and the other end to the windmill tower near the ground. Some people speculated that he was playing like he was a calf or a horse tethered to a fence. But eventually, he climbed up to the first crossbeam of the tower, which was above his head only a few feet, and fell on the opposite side of the crossbeam from which the other end of the rope was fastened. Now, it's possible he believed the rope was long enough for him to reach the ground because it was just short a few inches. But whether he fell or accidentally jumped thinking he had enough rope, his neck snapped. The housekeeper in the mansion discovered Billy a short time later and called the doctor, but it was too late. Dr. Haddix reported that his death had been instantaneous.
Pawnee Bill and May were understandably heartbroken, and May later said in a newspaper interview, "I don't know why it's so easy for me to win the applause of multitudes, but so hard just for me to be a mother." She had wanted him so much, and of course we know they didn't have any other children. Billy's service was held in the home, with Don Stoltz's father, Fred, officiating along with Reverend Rudy Ziegler, and he was interred at Pawnee's Highland Cemetery. His third grade class led the funeral procession from the home all the way out to the cemetery.
That thought just gives me chills.
Yeah.
Now, it's just such a difficult thing to talk about or to think about. And no one really wants to think that an 8-year-old can pass away in such a tragic way. And it's also very hard for the staff to talk about sometimes because Billy isn't just a little boy who died nearly 90 years ago. Inside that mansion, it feels like Billy is still there. Playing on that windmill tower was probably something that he had done 100 times in his life, and in one moment, everything changed. And people have such an emotional response to the story. I think it's the emotion behind it that almost does Billy a disservice, because we want to make this event so much bigger than it was, and in reality, it was simply about a little boy who was using his imagination and playing, and the unthinkable happened.
Right. The following Christmas, the Lillys bought a mausoleum for Billy's present. The previous year, his present had been that electric train that had come all the way from Philadelphia, and in 1925, they were building him a mausoleum. There's a quote from Pawnee Bill that always gets to me, and he's explaining why they decided to build the mausoleum. "That was all we could give Billy this year. I think he didn't mind lying on the hill all summer. But we could not leave him out there when the weather was cold and all the flowers were dead. And after all, he had to have a Christmas present."
Apparently, being without their boy that first Christmas was just too much for the Lillys to bear. And they packed up and headed south to San Antonio, where they wouldn't be reminded of the cold and they could take some time to themselves to continue healing. But they eventually returned to Blue Hawk Peak, and you have to think that their home was never really truly the same again. There were happy times in the years after Billy's passing, but when you look at all of Billy's items that the Lillys preserved, it's apparent that he was never far from their thoughts.
Yeah, and it's kind of like we're still taking care of him. I mean, we clean his toys, we file and document his papers, we set out, like right now at Christmas, we set out his Christmas drawings with little fake cookies for Santa from him. I like to smile when I think about Billy and the precocious little boy that he was. And, you know, most importantly, Anna, we remember Billy. I think we remember him as he and Pawnee Bill and May would want him remembered, as a beautiful boy who lived fully and died tragically, who was adored in life and cared for and loved even after his death.
Now, I like to play a little game with history where I ask myself, what if? What if a certain event had turned out differently? How would that have impacted history? And I know that when we were preparing for the Mexican Joe podcast, we talked about what we thought Billy would have been when he grew up. And we pretty much agreed that he would have been a star. He would have been a man just like his father. And who knows how he could have changed the world with all of his youth and energy and imagination. But I think the most lasting tribute to Billy is the one that his parents left him. Tucked inside that Bible in the mansion, along with his poem written about his mother, were two other items. One was a postcard picture of the bison grazing on the hill at Pawnee Bill's ranch. The other was a newspaper clipping, which was yellowed, but it was still in pristine condition. And it simply says, "In memoriam of our dear little son Billy Lilly, who left us March 31st, 1925. How we miss you every day. Mr. and Mrs. G.W. Lilly."
We hope that this podcast makes you think about Billy and the Lilly family a little differently. And we hope that it also reminds you to hold those you love just a little tighter. And we want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the Pawneeville Ranch. I'm Erin Brown.
And I'm Anna Davis. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Is owned and operated by the Oklahoma Historical Society. For more information, go to www.pawneevilleranch.com or find us on Facebook under Pawneeville Ranch and Museum.